offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Radio Sai, joining you live from our studios at Prashanthinilayam. And even as I join you, I hope all of you are keeping well and keeping safe. We are here to continue our discussion on the shlokas of chapter 9. We are in the second half of the chapter, and today we'll be discussing a very important verse. In Swami's own words, Swami has said that this is one of the most important verses of the Bhagavad Gita. We'll be discussing that. There is much to say about this shloka, and I wonder if I'll be able to do all of that today. So that's a heads up that we will be doing only one shloka, and even that may not be complete in this episode. Because apart from that shloka, there are some things that I want to read out, which are a prelude to the shloka, and Swami speaks about these things that I'm going to read out in connection with this shloka that we'll be discussing today. But before that, we will do a short summary of what we covered last time, because that context also is clearly more important. It's important to understand the shloka. We covered only two verses, 20 and 21. The 20th verse was about those that observe a ritual form of worship, especially the performance of a yajna, right? They are often spoken of as people who have a seeking for heaven, because if you really look at the scriptures, many of these yajnas are performed to Vedic deities like Rudra, Indra, Agni, and so on. And the phala, or the benefit of doing that, is a place in heaven, right? That's how the scriptures describe it. So Krishna states that even these people, they offer worship that reaches him and him alone. We discussed what is this general idea about heaven. When the scriptures say that the heaven is reward, it is also symbolic of a craving that each one of us have. Heaven is a punya loka, a realm where the fruits of good actions are enjoyed. And they are enjoyed in a manner that there is no effort involved in that enjoyment. We had discussed about this last time. So this, as we saw, is a concept of unlimited enjoyment, more so an extrapolation of our fancies, right? Just like how we wish to have a lot of things coming our way without having to put effort. The idea of heaven is there, is a place where all enjoyments and all pleasures of life come to you, and there is no limit or there is no boundaries as to how much you can enjoy them or how far or how long you can enjoy them. The point that Krishna makes in this discussion is that even if there is a concept like heaven, even if you were to get entry into a place such as that, there is no guarantee that that stay will be eternal. And we had discussed how that is so. Because if you're talking about a place where there is enjoyment without effort, without karma, then at some point that punya will run out, because there is no way you can perform more action to add to that punya that you have accumulated. So you will come back into this world of going and coming, and that's what he says in the very next shloka. He says that even if you reach heaven, even though you're worshipping me, your worship reaches me, you will be returning to this world of coming and going. So this Krishna is going to contrast with another set of worshippers from the next verse, and that's what also makes the next verse very important. The last week I had read a few passages from the Gita Vahini, chapter 19 to be precise, and Swami was speaking about how one must take up the study of the Gita itself. The portion that I read out was about those that expound the Gita, right? Those who are giving talks on the Gita, those who are doing a series on the Gita probably. I want to further read from that chapter today. The essence of all that is being said is that the Gita is not for being worshipped. It is not for being revered or praised. It is for being practiced. And even as we go through these passages, remember that these are a build up to this one very, very important shloka, the 22nd shloka of the 9th chapter. In fact, Swami speaks of that shloka as being something like a litmus test for those who speak about the Gita or those who claim that they are, those who are well-versed in the Gita, those who study the Gita. It is a very beautiful and profound shloka, needless to say, but we will come to that in a short while. Talking about the Gita, understanding the Bhagavad Gita or learning the Gita by heart, many of us may feel a bit inadequate. I don't know any verses from the Gita. I cannot memorize them. Or there is so-and-so who can quote any number of verses from the Gita, which I can't. Or the other way around, we may feel exalted and good about ourselves that we know so many shlokas from the Gita compared to the others. In this passage that I'm going to read out, Swami kind of trashes such idea and says that there is nothing like that. And very beautifully and graphically, Swami puts it, and Swami says, some boast that they have the entire Gita on the tip of their tongue, that they can roll out on the spot any verse from the Gita that you want to hear, given only the chapter and number. Or they can quote chapter and number for any phrase or word you can give. I am inclined to laugh when such scholarship is exhibited. Poor tongue, that it should carry so much on its tip without any of it being absorbed in actual life. A gramophone record can repeat as well as they can, and with equal benefit to itself. Practicing one verse certainly yields more benefit than learning all the verses by rote and retaining them in memory. Arjuna proved every word of Krishna true by practicing it. His sincerity won him the grace of Krishna. End of quote. Very profound words. Especially I love that statement. A gramophone record can repeat as well as they can and with equal benefit to itself. The benefit of merely memorizing the shlokas is as much as the benefit a gramophone, or in the modern terminology, a CD gets for holding such verses. If you have a CD with Bhagavad Gita shlokas, we will preserve it for its contents and probably will keep it with a lot of reverence and carefully we will preserve it. We will be preserving it and revering it for its contents, and it will receive some benefit from that reverence. But the gramophone will only remain a gramophone. A CD will only remain a CD, even if it contains all the 700 shlokas of the Gita, isn't it? Swami tells later in the same chapter, and he goes on, I quote, "The teachings of the Gita don't get the respect that the book gets. Thousands of people, when they see the sacred books, be it the Gita, the Ramayana, Bhagavata, Bharata, etc., bow their heads, press them to their eyes, place them on their head, keep them on a special seat in the shrine, and reverentially place a few flowers on them. They sit with closed eyes and with teardrops rolling down their cheeks. They fall prostrate before the books and rise very much satisfied with themselves. All that reverence is for the stack of paper, not for the contents of the books, the subjects they deal with. The head must carry not the weight of the paper, but the message explained thereon. Install it not on the altar, but in the heart. For it is only then that the authority of the Gita will be honored steadily at all times. The mind won't be cleansed of egotism or like evils by all this outward reverence, learning by rote, offering worship in shrine rooms, holding the head, pressing on the eyes, and so on. Let the message enter the heart. put it into practice and taste the joy that comes from it. That's the way to honor the Gita. End of quote. What beautiful words. And this is as much true for the Gita as it is true for Swami's message itself, isn't it? Reverence is certainly important. In fact, we started the Gita with a statement that Swami makes in the very first chapter of Gita Vaini. Swami said that to take up the study of the Gita, one must have puja bhavam, a reverential feeling, a reverential approach. But Swami also added two more points. He said, along with puja bhavam, you should have bahya nirikshana and bahiranga parikshana. Nirikshana means patience. And I'm inclined to say a patience that is born from the acknowledgement that what I'm reading is important and it has to be given its due time. Bahiranga parikshana means a sense of inquiry, a sense of inquisitiveness to adapt and try out the message that is being conveyed. Mere reverence is of no use. And I think that is what Swami conveys in those lines. And Swami continues in that same chapter, chapter 19. Swami says, the tastiest dish can never quell your hunger. If you place it on your head or press it to your eye or fall prostrate before it. The Gita is on a par with this. The Gita is a tasty dish, full of the sweet ingredients of bhakti, jnana, karma and vairagya or detachment. Eat it, drink it. One mouthful is enough. The hungry one does not need all the grain that is harvested. A handful of rice suffices. The thirsty one need not drink the Godavari dry. A glass of water is enough. He who has hunger for God need not consume the entire Gita. It can be quenched by practicing even one verse. A box of matches has many sticks. If you want to light a fire, you need to strike only one. You can nurture the little flame into a huge fire with care and diligence. The entire stock of sticks need not be struck. There are 700 matchsticks in the Gita. Each one is a stick from which you can light the flame of wisdom or jnana. Strike one on the stone of experience. That is enough. End of quote. It cannot be more clear than that, right? What Swami is saying, the whole idea of the Gita is, as in the very first episode I made that point, this is a text for sadhana, right? There are some texts for manana, there are some texts which are merely for contemplation and for clarifying our thought. You just have to read them and internalize them and contemplate on them probably. But the Gita is not a text like that. It is a text for sadhana. It is a text for applying in everyday life. In the same portion, Swami goes on to give an example which is in a way connected to the next shloka. So maybe we'll take it up after we go through the shloka itself. So finally, let us come to the shloka, the 22nd shloka of the 9th chapter. Speaking about the shloka, Swami says in the Gita Vaini, he says, Vyasa made a lovely garland using the words of Krishna as flowers. Of that garland, this verse is the crest. It is the central jewel of that garland of gems. That is how special this verse is. That's what Swami writes himself. Needless to say, it is one of the most quoted verses by Swami too. So we will listen to it and then discuss about it. I'm not sure if I can cover everything that Swami has spoken about this verse, because as I read out the passage last week, we always run the risk of misinterpreting the verses of the Gita, or for that matter, any scripture. And the saving grace for us is the ability to go back to Swami's Gita Vahini and Swami's discourses. So in that sense, I'm going to try to elaborately quote from Gita Vahini and some other discourses. But then, as I said, if I were to quote everything that Swami has said about this one verse, I think that'll take many, many episodes, and let me not do that. I will only give you an idea of what Swami talks about this verse by quoting from these works of Swami. And definitely, we don't have to read everything, right? That's the whole point that Swami is saying. We don't have to know everything to understand what Swami says about this Gita. We only need to know a little and practice that. And so, if our discussion on this verse inspires me and all of you a little bit to try out what Krishna is saying in this verse in our daily life, then I think we can consider our job well done, right? So with that, we'll go to the 22nd verse of the 9th chapter. We'll listen to it as always in the voice of Brother Shyam. Then we'll discuss in a lot of detail about this one verse.
Ananyaschintayanto maam ye janaah paryupasate tesham nityabhiyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham.
For those devotees who worship me alone, meditating on me with no other thought, who are ever steadfast, I carry the burden of their welfare. So that is that most important verse. In a different place in the Gita, Vahini explaining about this shloka, Swami says, this most sacred sentence is to the Gita as the navel is to the body. The navel of Vishnu was the place where Brahma took birth. This verse is the navel or place of nativity for those who thirst for the wisdom of Brahma. If this verse is followed in practice, the entire Gita can be understood. Nothing more needs to be said about this verse, isn't it? What an assurance Swami is giving there. If this one verse is followed in practice, the entire Gita can be understood. Why is it so profound? For one, it is one of the promises that Krishna makes to each one of us. On many occasions, Swami has said this, that there are three shlokas that are most important in the Gita. Paritranaya Sadhunam, the verse from the 4th chapter. This verse from the 9th chapter that we just heard. And Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ma sucha, from the 18th chapter, which I'm sure we will take a long time to reach given the speed at which we are going. So that is the third verse. As we can see, all three have a few things in common. All these three verses, all three verses are promises given by the avatar, and all three, especially the second and third, call upon us to surrender to the Lord. The promise is connected to this aspect of surrender. The other reason this shloka is profound is, this shloka can be said to describe a jnani, as well as it could be looked upon as an instruction or a direction for a sadhaka or a mumukshu, an aspirant. Of course, we have seen many such verses even before the 3rd chapter, 4th chapter, when Krishna speaks about karma yoga. He is actually describing a jnani, but it's a hint for the karma yogi. We have seen shlokas like that, right? But this is also one more shloka like that, and of course it has many layers of meaning. But before going into these approaches of looking at the shloka, let us first see what is the context in the chapter it appears in, or in this portion of the chapter it appears in. That is the most straightforward explanation for this shloka too. In the previous few shlokas, Krishna spoke of a certain type of worshipper, right? Those that perform rituals, or those for that matter, any kind of worship or prayer, hoping to achieve some special place in heaven. Or as we discussed last week, heaven is representative of a desire to enjoy something that they do not have, and they feel that they will be happy once they have. If you look at all the prayers that we make, all the submissions that we make in the form of a prayer to God, there are two kinds they can be categorized into. Let us take the example of a king who is going in for a battle. Right? In the ancient days, it was a practice that before the battle, the king would perform a yajna or perform a very elaborate puja, and that will be attended by the queen and all the other soldiers before they go into the battle. So what is the king praying for? He wants to win the battle, and he also wants to come back safe. He wants to come back alive, isn't it? Or he doesn't want to lose his kingdom, and or he wants to expand his boundaries. So that'll be the prayer that he's going to be making. So there are two prayers there. One, he wants to achieve something that he doesn't have. And the other, he wants to keep safe and secure what he already has. Almost all prayers fall into either of these categories or both of these categories. And that is why any prayer is said to be made for yoga kshema. We'll discuss more on this compound word, yoga kshema. But coming back to the context of the shloka, so Krishna spoke of those who have the desire to acquire some heaven or some enjoyment that is represented by the idea of heaven. So when they worship, either pray or do bhajans or perform a yajna or puja, they focus on the object that they wish to acquire. And Krishna said, they will get it, but then what they get will not be permanent. So he contrasts that with the kind of people that he is speaking of in this shloka. Those that do not think of anything else, and what happens to such people is what is described here. He says, ye janaha, those people, ananyaha chintayantaha. Ye janaha, those people, ananyaha chintayantaha, without thinking of others. We had discussed this word ananya a few shlokas back. Anyaha means others. Ananyaha means no others. Right? So ananyas chintayantaha means one who thinks of no other. Mam par upasate, and worships me. Tesham, of them, or there, nitya abhiyuktanam, of such people who are ever united in thought or are focused on the Lord. Nitya, eternally, abhiyuktanam, focused on the Lord. Yoga kshemam vahami aham. I carry the burden, or I am responsible for their yoga kshema. When you become an ananyaschintayanta, you automatically become a nitya abhiyuktaha, someone whose focus is sharp and firm on the Lord, right? And the promise is, for such a person, I am responsible, Krishna says. If you look at the word yoga kshema in the traditional sense, it can simply be translated to mean a person's needs. And Krishna is saying that the person becomes my responsibility, right? As I said, that needs can be acquiring something or keeping safe what one already has. So desires or needs or whatever one needs to carry on with this life. So Krishna is saying, I become that person's needs and that person's requirements become my responsibility. So the first and simple way of looking at this verse, based on this context of what Krishna has been speaking about, each one of us, whichever be the stage of spiritual progress we may possibly be in, we will have some needs at that station in our life. And these keep changing from time to time. The needs of a person, say, running the house is different. The needs of a person who is retired and is struggling with old age is different. But both can be devotees, both can be sadhakas, right? The simple worldly way that 99% or even more of the people in the world lead their life is, they fend for themselves. They look after their needs themselves. They know what they need at various times and they wholeheartedly pursue them. When God comes into the picture, He also becomes a means in this effort. I'm doing a business. I want success in that business so that I will get money and that money will help me take care of my family. I come to God to secure this dream of mine, to ensure this dream of mine. Or I'm married, I don't have children, I want something that I don't have. I turn to God and I pray for this. But Krishna is speaking here of those few for whom God is not the means, but God is the ends. Ananyas chintayanto mam paryupasate. Those who worship me, adore me, only thinking of me and nothing else. Now, who is capable of thinking of only one person without thinking of anything else or even of what can be gained through that relationship or through that person? Is it possible for anybody to think of another person like that? Well, that is possible only for one who has fallen in love, isn't it? It is only through love such fulfillment can be experienced. So this shloka describes perfectly the state of a devotee who has fallen madly in love with God. The devotee seeks nothing, not even a place in heaven or liberation for that matter. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, this state of the devotee is described in multiple places, right? This love that is so intense that it even is ready to give up liberation, ready to give up even the benefits of heaven. The story from the Bhagavatam that Swami would often quote is that of the Gopikas and Krishna putting up this drama of having a headache, right? We've heard that so many times. I might have even narrated it on this program, where the Gopikas say, it's all right if Krishna's headache is, he's relieved of his headache. So what if we have to rot in hell for eternity? That attitude comes only with love. And in the Bhagavatam, Sukhamuni and the other deities explain this in this manner. They say, you know, we spoke of this idea of heaven last week. As I said, it is nothing but the extrapolation of the idea of all enjoyment, limitless enjoyment and unbridled enjoyment. And if you really look at it, even the idea of liberation is one such exploration, or I'm sorry, extrapolation. The only difference is, when we speak of heaven, we speak from the point of view of enjoyment, right? Right now, I know that pleasures make me happy. I know that if I have good food, if I'm well taken care of, my body is taken care of, then there is a certain enjoyment. And I think of heaven as a place where this enjoyment is extrapolated. If you think of someone who's speaking of liberation, the idea of liberation comes with the maturity that enjoyment will not give me, or pleasures will not give me happiness, but conquering the desire for such pleasures will give me happiness. When that maturity comes, the idea that freedom will give me happiness steps into the mind. And what we talk of liberation is nothing but the extrapolation of this idea of freedom will give me happiness. So just like how for a worldly person, heaven is the ultimate expression of what he thinks is going to give him happiness. For a mumukshu, for a sadhaka, the idea of liberation or mukti is nothing but the extrapolation of his idea of what is going to give him happiness, that is a certain amount of freedom. So both these ideas are based on a joy that one is able to experience right now in this material existence, be it a mumukshu or be it a samsari, a worldly person, isn't it? The Srimad Bhagavatam says, a devotee is so intoxicated in love for the Lord that nothing in the world interests her or him. Then how can the idea of heaven or the idea of liberation, which are nothing but mental extrapolations of the joys of the present, be of any interest to such a devotee? Swami would often say that the best example for such devotion, such madhura bhakti, right? It is called madhura bhakti because madhu also means to be intoxicated, intoxicant. So madhura bhakti means that devotion is so intoxicating that nothing is more satisfying and beautiful than just being in love. And Swami would say that the best example for such madhura bhakti are the gopikas. This episode from the lives of gopikas has been mentioned by Swami many times in his discourses. Swami spoke of this in one of the Samukos discourses, 1979. Right? Swami says that Krishna sends Uddhava to drive some sense into the minds of these gopikas. Why Krishna is sending Uddhava? Because Uddhava felt that these gopikas are so uninformed. They do not have any knowledge about spirituality. And because of that, they've got attached to this physical form of Krishna. And so they are in misery. So Uddhava says that, you know, probably they should be educated. They should be taught the spiritual wisdom that there is only one, there is no two. Advaita Jnanam has to be given to them. So Krishna says, oh, is that so, Uddhava? I think you're absolutely right. You're a very wise man. So why don't you go and drive sense into these gopikas? So Krishna sends Uddhava, and when Uddhava goes and tells them, you all should take up the study of the Shastras and the Upanishads and attain yoga or union with the true Krishna. Swami says that one of the gopikas, her name was Neeraja, she comes and says, oh great sir, but what can we do? We have only one mind. Not many. And that one mind has gone away to Mathura with our Krishna. We cannot understand what you say or the scriptures without our mind, can we? So that is the answer this Gopika Neeraja says. We would love to understand what you're saying, but we had only one mind, and that one mind is filled with Krishna. It is with Krishna. Swami says that this is Ananya Chintana. The mind cannot be fragmented when it is truly in love with God. It is given wholly to the Lord. And when the mind is given to the Lord in that manner, the mind has no liking for anything, worldly or otherworldly. Swami says in that same discourse that he delivered in 1979, that one should not fragment one's mind, and one must be able to offer the mind in its entirety, not just one bit of it, to God. You know, when we were infants, probably we have been in a state which is quite similar to that. We wanted nothing but to be by the side of our mother, probably. That didn't mean that we didn't have needs, right? There was hunger, the diaper needed to be changed, there were aches and pains, and there would be sometimes an ant biting us, or there might be other health issues in the body, even though we are infants. But the mother would be responsible for the care. And most often, we did not even have to ask. When a worldly mother can take care, of the yoga kshema of her child in this manner. Is there any surprise that a devotee who is so madly and haplessly in love with the Lord, that the Lord will not take care of him? That is why this yoga kshema that Krishna is talking about is much more than just the physical well-being, but it certainly includes physical well-being too. Let us focus a little on this term, yoga kshema, because it's the central part of, it's one of the important parts of the shloka, and multiple understandings to this. Swami himself has given all those understandings. I would like to read out a few passages where Swami explains yoga kshemam and what it stands for. One, as I said, is the simple idea that there are things that I want to acquire. We refer to them as yoga. Yoga means union, right? So yoga represents that, those things or those attainments which I want to have union with. Kshema means welfare, protection. So there are some things that I already have and I want to keep them safe. I already have health, I want to preserve my health. I've made a lot of money, I want to preserve my money. I have a family around me, I want them to be happy. I want them to, you know, sometimes status quo has to be maintained in many of these things. So yoga kshemam is that, what I want to attain and to preserve what I already have. The other interpretation is, I want to acquire something, which is yoga, and having acquired it, now I wish to retain it. Like we've been speaking about jnana or the spiritual maturity. We don't have it, right? We don't want to have it and then lose it after some time. You know, I gain all the spiritual knowledge and maturity and one fine day death comes calling and everything is gone away. We don't want knowledge or maturity in that manner. We want to have it, we want to achieve it, and we don't want to lose it. So we want to attain it in a manner that it cannot be taken away from me. That's why Swami says in the Gita Vahini, in another statement, and I quote, he says, the words yoga and kshema used by the Lord here mean acquisition of something desirable and preservation of what is thus acquired. Now, I often think of the spiritual journey as being very similar to, you know, the sport of rock climbing. The climber is careful about or is constantly doing two things. One, he or she is trying to go up, but at the same time, the climber is also trying to ensure that they don't slip down. Many times they may just be hanging there in one place. They might be making no progress towards the summit, but they'll just be hanging there, ensuring that they don't slip any further. They gather themselves and then they move forward up, right? Move upwards. So they balance between the effort to go higher and the effort to not fall. I think the same is the case with the spiritual journey too. It is like rock climbing. We want to progress, but also we want to ensure that we don't slip any further down. So sometimes we might be stuck in nothing, no progress, not moving forward. Oh, Swami, I've been coming here for 20 years and I'm not making any progress. Sometimes just to stay there is also an achievement and requires a lot of effort. Swami gives another interpretation to this phrase, yoga kshema. And this is again an excerpt from the Samashavas 1979. This is chapter 29. And Swami says, and I quote, yoga is the prapti, obtaining of the unattainable, and the Lord should confer it on you. While kshema is the experiencing of something that is rightfully your due. Here is an illustration for this. While reading a book, you keep a 5-rupee note in it, and as time passes, you forget about it. However, on a later date, you are in need of 5 rupees. And so you ask for it from a friend who has come to visit you. The friend accidentally picks up the book, comes across the 5 rupees in it, and then hands it over to you. Now, the money is actually yours, and the friend has only given you what is really your own. In the same way, joy is within you. Through you, the joy is within you, though you are not aware of it. The Sadguru is the friend who helps you unearth this treasure of happiness that is lying hidden in your own heart. End of quote. A very profound point being made there by Swami. Yoga is something that is unattainable through human effort, whereas Kshema is something that can be attained through your own effort. Kshema is the result of one's own good actions, one's own merit coming from, you know, some past action that one has performed. So for Kshema, one doesn't have to be a devotee or someone who is thinking of God without any other thoughts. Ananyas chintayanto maya, as he said. What is yours will come to you. But in the case of such a devotee who is having such focus on the Lord becomes the ordainer. Yoga kshemam vahami aham. I will carry the responsibility. Just like in that example that Swami gave, if the friend had found that money in the book and given it to me on a regular day, well, I would have been happy to find the money that I had kept long back. But when it is given to me when I am in need, that same money becomes more precious and more important and gives me so much more joy and peace. When we say that God carries the burden of yoga kshema, that's what it means. He will help me reach the state that I could not have reached on my own. As Swami said, yoga is that thing that is unattainable with human effort. So he is going to ensure yoga. He will help me reach that which I cannot attain on my own. And he will ensure what is my due comes to me in the most appropriate time in my life. By turning to the Lord in this manner, constantly thinking of Him, constantly in love with Him, we are giving Him this role where He says, Swami, I will have needs, I will have requirements, but you choose which need has to be answered when. And this shloka, as I said, also is an advice, right? It is not only a promise, it is also an advice. How does it describe a jnani? We will come to that part a little later, because that is it's an absolute description of the shloka. What it means to a sadhaka, what is that instruction to a sadhaka, that is more important to us, because that is what makes this shloka practicable. And from all that excerpts that we read from Swami's Gita Vahini, Swami wants this shloka to be practicable, practiced. And the message of this shloka that Swami was driving through all those passages is that it was this message that the shloka gives needs to be internalized, and that is something like the basis of the idea of trying to practice the Gita itself. In fact, Swami starts his explanation about the shloka in the Gita Vahini. If you were to go and read those chapters, I think that's the 18th chapter, he starts with the Chinnakatha. And Swami has related the story multiple times in many of his discourses. You would have heard it also. Swami says that there are many ways the shloka can be explained, but let me explain it with this Chinnakatha. Swami tells the story as follows. There is a learned pundit who is giving a discourse on the Gita. And he's doing it in the court of a king. One day the turn of this verse comes, the 22nd verse of the 9th chapter. So just like me, the Pandit started giving the many various interpretations and layers of meanings for each of those words from different angles, and yoga means this, kshema means this, ananyas chintayantaha means this. And the king kept shaking his head to indicate that he disagreed with all these explanations that this Pandit was giving. But unlike me, this Pandit was highly intellectual and well-read. So he had the force of all his learning and whatever he had memorized. So he started digging out more and more interpretations, quoting the various scriptures and saying that this is what it means. But the king kept shaking his head and he said, "No, I do not agree with this." And he felt very insulted, especially when the king simply said, "No, all of what you said is wrong." And the Pandit tried some other explanation for these words, but finally the king stops him. He gets up and he says, "Find out the meaning for this verse, and having understood it well, come to me again tomorrow." And the king walks out of the court. So the Pandit is absolutely distraught. He goes back home. He crashes on his cot and he's absolutely despondent. The wife who sees this comes to him and asks, "What happened? Why are you so low today? What happened in the court?" And she was going on asking all these questions. So the Pandit relents and he starts telling the events in the court that day. And after hearing all of this, the wife very coolly and calmly says, "Well, yes, it is correct that the king did not agree with you. The fault was in you and your explanation." Hearing this, the Pandit lost it. He got up and he started shouting at his wife, "What do you know? You know, what scriptures have you read for you to say that my explanation is wrong? And don't you know that I'm a scholar? I've read so many books and I've given so many discourses. How can you say that I'm wrong?" The wife very calmly tells him, "Why are you getting upset with me? Sit down, think calmly, recite the verse and contemplate on it. Then you will understand why the king told that you are wrong and why I am telling you that you are wrong." And the Pandit sits down and he starts reciting this verse very, very slowly and thoughtfully. But he's not able to understand what is wrong with his explanation. Then the wife asks him, "For what did you go to the king in the first place?" When she asks this again, he gets very upset. He says, "What do you mean for why I go to the king? You know, how else do you think I'm going to provide for the family? Don't I have to run this house? Don't I need money to feed all of you? I go to him for that only, and this is my livelihood." Then the wife replied, "If you had only understood what Lord Krishna declared in this verse, the urge to go to this king would not have arisen at all. If he is worshipped without any other thought, if one but surrenders to him, if at all times the mind is fixed on him, then the Lord has declared in this verse that he will provide everything for the devotee. You have not done these three. You approach the king believing that the king will provide everything. That is where you have gone against the very meaning of this verse. And that is why the king did not accept your explanation." So the Pandit sits down and thinks very deeply about what his wife has told. And then he realizes the mistake that he was doing. The next day, the king comes to the court and he finds that the Pandit has not come. And he says, "What happened? Why hasn't he come?" And the king is informed that the Pandit never came to the court. He's still at his house. So the king sends some messengers. He says, "Go and bring the Pandit here." When the messengers go to the Pandit's house, the Pandit tells them, "Look, there is no need for me to go to anyone. My Krishna will provide me with everything that I need. He will bear my welfare himself. I suffered insult in the king's court because I did not realize this for so long. Being blinded by eagerness to know the manifold meanings of mere words, I was lost. If I surrender to him, if I surrender to Krishna, and ceaselessly engage in worshipping Him, He will provide me with what I need. This is the message He gives to the messengers, and the messengers convey this to the king. And when the king listens to this, he himself comes walking barefoot all the way from the palace to the Pandit's house, and he falls prostrate in front of the Pandit and he says, "I thank you for explaining this verse to me now." And that is the power of experiencing and trying to practice 1 ounce of what the Lord says. And Swami says that anyone who claims to know the Gita or lectures on it does not have this faith that the Lord will take care of my yoga and shema is someone who has clearly not gone deeper than just the words. Especially for one who is trying to explain to others. Not just me, not just somebody who's doing a radio program. Even if you or me are trying to explain it, say, to our children, without practice of this faith, explanations will be hollow and potentially dangerously wrong. Because when we are not practicing what is being conveyed, we run the risk of trying to misinterpret the words itself. Swami writes about this by giving an example, again, Gita Vahini, and Swami says, the 10th verse of chapter 6 of the Gita declares that accepting help from others, parigraha, is a great sin. Now, those who accept the Gita as authority should act accordingly, avoiding help or avoiding parigraha, isn't it? Parigraha means accepting even for the upkeep of the body and the maintenance of dharma. These preachers, however, do accept 99% of them. The condemnation of accepting help applies to all forms. There are no modifying circumstances or exceptions. Yet, collections and contributions are asked for parigraha, sacrifices, as an offering, during waving of lights in a ritual worship, as expenses for the community of parigraha preachers, as gifts for the guru. Tickets are sold for lectures, just as for entertainment like drama and cinema. People who do this have no faith in the words of Krishna. For had they faith, they would not have behaved in such contrary ways. If they were convinced that it is wrong, they would not be tempted to act so. They explain the verse and feel that their duty is done. They do not feel the need to follow the advice themselves. That is the spirit of the times. For this is the age of hypocrisy. People who watch this type of Gita preaching lose faith first in the preacher and later in the Gita itself. The publicity dissolves into mere pomp and vanity. End of quote. So as you can see, the entire chapter in the Gita Vahini, from which I read out extensively, is based on this hypocrisy or inability to live by the Gita. If you recall, one of the first plays that Swami ever wrote, even as a child in school, he writes of how the mother is explaining about a spiritual text, I think the Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Gita, and she doesn't practice what she just explained to the audience. I'm not reading out all that Swami has written in that chapter because that will take a lot of time, but I would really suggest that we should go and read chapter 19 of Gita Vahini, because Swami speaks so directly to us and repeatedly tells us that here is the Lord's assurance. What a great promise this is from Krishna. I will take care of everything that you need. But this is a promise where the condition is ananya chintayanta mam ye jana paryupasate. You should be a devotee who is worshipping me and me alone. Swami says, the assurance, the promise, is the head, but no head can function independently of the limbs. holding fast only to the head, apart from the neck and shoulders and the rest of the body, is like putting faith in the key in one's hand after the iron safe has been stolen. Of what use is the key after the treasure is burgled? So there is the promise that he will take care of everything, but the precondition for that is the ability to think of him and worship him and worship him alone. But is it really possible? Right? That's what bothers us. Is it really possible to think of the Lord and only of the Lord? A couple of hours from now, I will start feeling hungry. Then my mind will be thinking about food. Or some of you might have the duty of cooking. So you'll be thinking of what food to cook. I go for work and my boss gives me an assignment. My boss says that I want you to do this presentation. I want you to prepare this report. Then my mind will be engaged in that work that has been assigned to me. Is it really possible for me to have no other thoughts? Well, we've discussed this multiple times before. I will just briefly repeat that and also read out a few lines from the Gita Vaini from this portion. As we go through life, we place before ourselves multiple goals. As a kid going to school, we probably had a simple task. We wanted to please our parents. We wanted to make them happy. We wanted to get a good name from our school, our teachers, so that our parents will be happy. Then as we grow a little older, we have a peer group around us. Pleasing our friends became the next task. And slowly we get a job. Pleasing the boss becomes a task. We get married. Pleasing the wife or pleasing the husband becomes a task. With more relationships and responsibilities being added unto us, the number of people we seek to please through life increases to an unimaginable and unsustainable number. And this is the cause for our desperation. And we even turn to God only out of such desperation. All that we have to do is replace this multitude of people whom we want to please and take care of, whom we want to honor and whom we want to respect, with just one. Instead of seeking and striving to please and satisfy so many, the goal must be to satisfy only him. The word chinta, ananya chinta, Swami would recite in his discourses, a beautiful Telugu poem. Swami says, puttuta oka chinta, birth is a worry. Bhumi nunduta oka chinta, to live on earth is a worry. Samsaram oka chinta, the family life is a worry. Chavu chinta, death is a worry. Balyamantayu chinta, childhood is a worry. Vridhakyam oka chinta, old age is another anxiety. Jeev chinta, jeevinchuta oka chinta, to lead life is a worry. Chelimi chinta, friendship is a cause of worry. Karmalanniyu chinta, all actions are cause for worry. Kashtam oka chinta, troubles cause worry. Santasam oka chinta, happiness is worry. Vinta chinta, beauty causes worry. Swami says in the end of that particular verse, he says, sarva chintala bapedi deva prema. The one that will relieve all the worries is divine love. O people, seek that divine love at least now. So the word chinta does not mean merely thoughts, but it also means worry, or more precisely, what makes you thoughtful. Right? If something is, you're obsessed with something, or something is occupying your interests, that fills your thoughts. As Swami said, when you have love for God, you have now only one chinta. How do I please my Swami? He becomes my only boss. You may take orders from a boss in the office, but you are working only to please this one boss. When we were in Swami's college, we would say this. The word BOSS, B-O-S-S, is an acronym that stands for Bhagwan Omnipotent Satyasai, BOSS. This switch has to be made by each one of us. I might be providing for a family. I might be working under so many bosses. I might be doing so many things. But in my mind, in my approach to my life, I have only one person I'm reporting to. There's only one person I'm trying to please. The moment he becomes my boss, the moment he becomes the only one I'm trying to please and work for, Swami says everything else will fall in place. Then all activities will be done with the single motive of trying to please him. Sarva karma bhagavat priti artham. And automatically you will be doing the right thing. Automatically the right duties will be performed, isn't it? In the Chinnakatha of that pandit and the king, I feel Swami pointed out that subtlety. The pandit thought he had to use all his scholarship to provide for the family. He had the attitude that he needs the favor of the king. If the attitude was, I have this role, this is my responsibility to talk about the scriptures, to explain the scriptures, and I'm carrying out this to please my Krishna. And what is needed for me, he will provide for me. If he chooses to provide it through the king, it will come through the king. Swami says in Gita Vahini, and I quote, you surrender to others, you praise and extol others, you are immersed in other thoughts. How then can he assume the burden? You serve others and press the Lord for reward. How can this be undivided loyalty, ananya chintana? The servant of the king must serve the king wholeheartedly. If the servant serves the king and is attached to his family, it cannot be termed unswerving loyalty. Serve whom you love. Love whom you serve. This is the secret of surrender, Sharanagati. End of quote. Serve whom you love. Love whom you serve. That is the secret of surrender. What beautiful words. Not all of us have been blessed with a state of mind to have love for God, but having been given the taste of being able to love God, nothing else is required, right? That's the essence of this shloka itself. You do not have to think of anything else. You do not have to worry about any other ritual. Do whatever you do to please him as an offering to him. I'm not bothered about heaven. I'm not bothered about liberation. I'm not bothered about anything else. Right? Swami says that if I can give him that place of priority in my life, I will have my yoga kshema taken care of. If it so happens that I am still in distress, if there is some problem, and I'm wondering why Swami is not taking care of my yogakshema, then what I have to go back to is to check my attitude. Where am I not focused on him? And correct it there. There are a few more things that I wanted to read out. I don't think we'll have the time for that. And as I said, there is a way of looking at this shloka as a description of a jnani too, and we'll have to cover that as well. So we will do all of that next week. I'm already running a little late. Thank you, dear listeners, for giving me this opportunity to read all of this to myself and to read it aloud in the pretext of doing this program. I do hope it has benefited each one of you in some way. And if it has, I think all credit goes only to Swami, and I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu. I'll join you again at 12 in the next episode of the afternoon satsang. But till I meet you next week at 10 a.m. on the Gita series, keep safe, take care, Jai Sai Ram.